877-6.
Welcome to the Prophecy Chronicles with your host, Paul Richard Price.
And hello, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, no matter on the globe where you're at. It is Paul Richard Price here with another episode of the Prophecy Chronicles. My guest tonight is Mark McCandlish, the man most noted for his work on the alien reproduction vehicle artwork that he did way back in the early to mid 90s. He's on the show tonight to discuss a little bit about his history and about, you know, what's happening with the Gulf oil spill debacle and how alternative technologies could help us in the future never have that problem again. And Mark, are you there?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I am doing good. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, if any of you would like to ask Mark a question, feel free to do so via the chat room log. He's going to be logging in pretty soon. And when he does, he'll be able to answer your questions directly. And if not, then I will be the one doing so. And also, I want to thank all of you who are listening at in New Orleans at 105.5 FM. Thank you for listening. As well, Mark, could you explain to my listeners who may not know who you are, who is Mark McCandlish?
Well, thank you, Paul. I appreciate you having me on again. And once again, congratulations for that last show you did. Was it 138,000 listeners? That's fantastic.
Well, I mean, I got information indicating that it was a really high number from Joe last week, and I was kind of shocked about it, and I went, well, thank God about that. But more importantly, what I'd like to do is get into the topic right now and to, first of all, get people to know who you are.
Okay.
And who is Mark McCandlish?
Okay. Well, for the better part of the last 30 years, I spent most of my time illustrating and designing weapon systems for a number of defense contractors that supply weapon systems and aircraft and so forth for the United States Department of Defense. I worked with all the major defense contractors and aerospace companies, Boeing, Rockwell, Allied Signal, General Electric, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Northrop, McDonnell Douglas. It was really exciting work for many years. More and more of this work is now being done by computer-generated imagery. But, you know, I was creating images that were created basically using paintbrushes, paint, and, you know, masonite, airbrushing, and things like that. And in the process of being involved in this particular kind of career, I worked for most of these clients as an independent consultant. Had a security clearance through the level of secret, both while I was in the Air Force working on F-106s back in the early 1970s, and then again when I worked directly with General Dynamics in the early 1980s. So when I left General Dynamics and began freelancing, working for different defense contractors, this was, of course, a big plus for me. And, you know, it took a few years. It was probably, I think it was in the mid-1980s, around 1986, I received a commission with Lockheed Martin, and was asked to do piece of conceptual artwork for a new family of advanced technology aircraft. It was a high-altitude, air-breathing type of platform that was supposed to go really fast, and they really couldn't tell me how fast it was supposed to go. It was all classified. They couldn't even tell me what it was supposed to look like, but they asked me to create an aircraft that that would look like it was really fast. And in the process, what I did was I went back through my library and I pulled out the reference material I had on the two fastest known aircraft at that time, which was, of course, the SR-71 Blackbird, which some say was capable of something approaching Mach 2.5 or almost Mach 3. And then, of course, the Rockwell International North American Aircraft XB-70 from the early 1960s, which was capable of at least Mach 2. It's a huge stainless steel aircraft, a big white bird. There were two of them built. One of them crashed in flight testing. But anyhow, so I combined features from these two aircraft. The XB-70 had a large triangular wing, and it had wingtips that would fold down, creating a kind of compression lift. It had two large tails, or vertical stabilizers, and then it had a kind of a long gooseneck fuselage that would come out of the middle of that large triangular wing, and just behind the cockpit were a pair of these smaller wings called canards that would help to control and prevent stall, or, you know, the aircraft, you know, reaching too high of an angle of attack versus the flow of the air around the aircraft. And then I combined that with the little razor sharp edge that went around the length of the fuselage on the SR-71 Blackbird, referred to as a chine. And then instead of you know, two big round engines embedded in the wing like on the SR-71, I went with a pair of split squarish nacelles under the wings, somewhat similar to what is found on the B-1B strategic bomber. But I was leaning towards something that looked a little bit more like a supersonic combustion ramjet or scramjet, which tends to have more of a straight, you know, sort of silhouette, because the air is flowing through it so quickly that, you know, all these fancy curves and stuff do nothing but just increase the drag and the heat on the airframe. So anyway, I combined all these features into this this one drawing, and I took my sketch pad down, and the fellow who I was dealing with at the time, it was the a division of Lockheed that was based in Calabasas, California, and I sat down across from two guys who looked like you know, stereotypical scientists with the lab coats and the little glasses and the receding hairline, and opened up my sketch pad, turned it around, slid it across the table, and I thought these two guys were going to have a heart attack when they saw my drawing, and by the reaction that I received and the things that were said, not only did I guess that I had stumbled upon what was actually a proposal that they were dealing with, but I had come so close to actually duplicating it in my drawing that these men both became very nervous. You could literally see the beads of sweat beginning to form on their foreheads. One guy, his hands began shaking, and he got real red in the face, and he says, you know, what are these canards doing on there? And what are these vertical stabilizers moved out to the wingtips? I mean, these things would be ripped off at Mach 7. You know, you start to say 17. Mach 17, if you can imagine, in 1986. And you know, and then he caught himself, and he kind of shut down. And I said, well, you know, I'm not really sure why you guys are so upset. I was asked to come up with a drawing of something that would look like it was really fast, and all I've really done here is combine features from the XB-70 and the SR-71. I mean, I don't understand why you're so upset. You know, if those, you know, if those aircraft can tolerate these kinds of structural features at up to Mach 3, then, you know, if I need to modify this so it'll meet the criteria of, you know, however fast your plane's going to go, then please tell me. I'm happy to make the changes, but, you know, you don't have to yell at me. So anyway, they wound up giving me information for what wound up being a totally bogus design. It looked like an ice cream cone with fins on it, and that's essentially what I wound up painting to help them promote this this new family of aircraft. But in the process, the fellow that I was dealing with, who was sort of the account executive interfacing between what turned out to be Lockheed Skunk Works and this division in Calabasas, the fellow told me that an earlier version of the same kind of aircraft within the same family of aircraft, which later became known as the Aurora aircraft, that the first version or the first type of this aircraft that was designed and built had multiple propulsion systems. And I understood this to mean that there was, you know, something like a typical jet engine with you know, a combination of a turbojet engine and a scramjet engine that would cycle from one to the other to allow it to take off at one speed, and then once it got up to its maximum speed using a turbojet engine, it would cycle to a supersonic combustion jet engine, and that would allow it to go up to much higher speeds. And anyway, in the process of discussing this aircraft, the fellow that I was working with told me, you know, not too long ago, we had one of these things have a malfunction, and the pilot was bringing it into Edwards Air Force Base and had a problem. He couldn't cycle down to the slower speed engine and propulsion system, so he was ordered to take it out over the Pacific Ocean to try and sort out the problem, and if he couldn't fix the problem, to bury it in the ocean so it would never be found, you know, at high speed, and presumably he would eject and be rescued. Anyway, the gentleman said it took the guy 15 minutes to fix the problem, and by that time he was over Hawaii. Now, to the average person, this probably doesn't sound like a whole lot of disclosure, but what the guy just told me was volumes of information. I had just recently returned from a scuba diving trip to Hawaii, so I knew it was 3,000 miles away from California. If you can go 3,000 miles in 15 minutes, that means you're flying 12,000 miles per hour. I mean, it's real basic mathematics. Maybe this fellow thought that because I was an artist, I wouldn't be able to figure that out, but I mean, that's just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, I don't even know. Well, of course, it would depend on the altitude that the aircraft was traveling at in order to determine what the actual Mach number is. But I'm imagining that it's something between Mach 6 and Mach 10, which is just absolutely astounding, at least for that day and age. In 1986, it was. But the aircraft that they wanted me to draw that was replacing that was capable of something almost three times faster. So that was when I understood that there was just an entirely different, a higher tier of technology that was out there that was being researched and developed and presumably deployed. And that's when I began to realize that there was a whole lot more going on behind the scenes that, you know, even with my connections in the defense industry, I didn't even know about. So that kind of encouraged me to start looking at other areas. And that was the very thing that was going on in the back of my mind when a friend of mine told me about seeing the so-called alien reproduction vehicle sitting in the Lockheed Skunk Works hangar in November of 1988. So that's an entire other story. I could spend 2 hours telling you about how that all happened and how I found out what I did. But to boil it all down into just a few statements, a friend of mine saw these things, captured enough information from having seen these things in sort of unpredictably during what was supposed to be an air show that he and I were supposed to both attend, that the interesting thing about my friend is that he has almost a photographic memory, and so everything that he saw he was able to reproduce in the form of drawings. And even though he's more of a designer and less of an artist like I am, he was able to provide me enough information that I was able to sort of transcribe all this information, take all the dimensions and everything that he said were attributable to this design, and then draft it all out and put it into the form of a cutaway illustration, which is what eventually became the blueprint known as the Alien Reproduction Vehicle, or ARV. So that's where that came from. And the power source that this thing was using was something that was referred to as zero-point energy. There are slang terms for this kind of energy. It's been called everything from longitudinal waves, which was a term that I think Nikola Tesla used back in the early 1900s, to it's called scalar energy, psychotronic energy, space energy. But the actual physical, if you were a physicist and you were talking to some of your contemporaries, you would probably say something like quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum. That's one of the more technical descriptions of this particular type of energy. So that's where it all came from. That's how it happened. And, of course, once I started poking around and asking questions and making drawings, it had a pretty severe impact on my career working with the military and the defense establishment. And it's at this point now, it's probably been about 5 years since I've actually done the work for the military. Probably more than likely as a direct consequence of that, and sort of coming out of the woodwork and speaking at the National Press Club with Stephen Greer and the folks from the Disclosure Project. It's a real technology. We do have it. We've had it since the mid-1960s. There's no telling just how advanced this particular technology is today. in the, you know, the, at the end of the first decade of the 21st century. I mean, it's probably at a stage now where if the truth were known, I would say there's a very strong possibility that not only do we have aircraft or vehicles of this kind based on this technology that are flying all over the solar system, but there's probably a good possibility that they've actually traveled to some of the nearest stars as well.
Well, I've also heard the term now in physics. It's a new term for what we call zero-point energy, Mark. They call it negative energy now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same difference, but being that zero-point energy has been related to UFOs and the man-made flying saucer, you know, genre classifications, zero-point energy has become an embarrassing term now for them, but they call it negative energy,
yeah,
which, in effect, is zero-point energy.
Well, I know. But, I mean, there's so many different phrases that can be used in physics, and, you know, like you say, Paul, if you're not up on the latest jargon, you can wind up sounding a little foolish, and it's, of course, something that even I have gone through on occasion. But you know, negative energy. You know, if you're not in the know, you might think, well, that means antimatter or you know, something of that nature. And you have the different kinds of energy that can be trapped or I should say tapped through either fusing or splitting the atom. You know, taking a couple of atoms, bringing them together in a nuclear fusion reaction, which is what the hydrogen bomb is based on, or you could also, you know, there's so many different ways that you can tap into these kinds of energy. The way that I've tried to understand this in my own mind's eye is that there is an energy that's actually embedded in the fabric of space-time itself. This energy, and this is one of the things that was never really clearly explained to us when you and I went through high school and we were studying physics and things like that. There was never a time when somebody sat down and said, well, you know, all the little subcomponents in the atom, like electrons and neutrons and protons, all these things are in constant motion. They never slow down. They're always moving. In fact, even Einstein said that matter could neither be created nor destroyed, but that it can be converted to energy and energy converted to matter. Well, so the question became, and the question that was never answered for us in those days was, if there's no such thing as perpetual motion, then how come the structure of the atom never seems to be subject to the laws of entropy? That is, the laws of frictional losses. Why don't the electrons ever slow down and just collapse into the nucleus of the atom? Why does the atom persist? Why does it never stop? And the reason is because the little tiny components, the electrons, neutrons, and protons, within the structure of the atom, are constantly in a state of absorbing this energy, this quantum zero-point energy, from the fabric of space-time. In fact, when Einstein was talking about, you know, the reason that you could never travel at faster than the speed of light was because as you accelerate, as you move more and more quickly through space-time, through the fabric of space, that your mass increases. Now, most people think of mass as some kind of quantifiable object, like the weight of a big piece of steel. And it's really not the weight per se, because that has more to do with gravity than anything else. But mass itself is actually based on a lot of different things, whether an object is moving, whether it's at rest, whether it's, you know, spinning around another object. All these things have an influence on what the actual mass of an object is. But when you move more quickly through space-time, regardless of whether you're moving in a circular orbit or whether you're going in straight-line acceleration, as you do that, your mass increases. So you start to understand that mass is not so much a quantity as it is an effect. And the reason the mass increases is because as you move faster and faster faster through space-time, your object, whether, you know, spaceship, whatever it is, it's interacting more and more often with this energy that's sprinkled throughout the vacuum of space-time. Let's say, for example, you are riding a bicycle through a rainstorm, and it's just sprinkling. There, you know, the drops of water are sort of distributed evenly through the environment. They're spaced out, so it's not raining very hard. It's just sprinkling. Now, if you travel through that environment at, say, 3 miles an hour, you get so many impacts of rain droplets for every couple of feet that you travel. But the faster you travel, the more of those raindrops you are struck by and are absorbed into your clothes. So if you move at a certain speed through the environment, you only get so wet. But if you go through the environment really quickly, like, say, 100 miles an hour, before you know it, you're soaked. Now, think of the wetness, the absorption of all that water, as being like the increase of mass that occurs when you accelerate through space-time. So what happens is, as you move faster and faster through space-time, you're having more and more interaction with this energy that's in the environment. But what happens is, if you were able to go down at the atomic level and look at all the atoms in your spacecraft as it accelerates through space-time, what you find is that the atoms, the structure inside the atom, all those little particles, the electrons, neutrons, protons, they begin spinning faster and faster and faster. And so just like a little gyroscope or like a child's top, you know, where the little string you pull off and everything, if it spins faster and faster, it begins to manifest a greater and greater effect of its own internal sort of gravitational field. So you wind up with an effect of greater mass, but the actual size of the atoms hasn't changed. The spacecraft is not bigger. It's not larger, it's not heavier, but it has a greater effect of mass. And it's because it's storing all this extra energy that's being absorbed as you accelerate space-time. Now, the interesting thing about all of this is that as you slow down, as you decelerate, all of that energy is expended. It goes back out into space again. And so your vehicle, you know, comes to a stop. And that's, of course, all relative because everything in the universe is always in motion anyway. But it basically comes back to sort of a static position relative to its surroundings. And all of that mass that it inherited is now gone. It's back to where it was before, to its sort of, what would you call it? It's, there's a term for this, and I forget at the moment what it is. But it's sort of a steady state. I think that's the proper term. If you come back to this position where you haven't got all this extra mass, then it shows you that this is a variable process. This is something that can increase, it can decrease, it can go up and down, and it changes relative or as a result of your accelerating through the environment and interacting with this energy form. So, okay, let's go back to the guy riding the bicycle through the environment and getting wetter and wetter and heavier as clothes are all soaked with water. Let's say you put a big old funnel out in front of your bicycle so that you capture all of that rain that's going to hit you and make you heavier. And instead of making you heavier, this funnel captures all that rain and it ducts it back to a little steam engine that's driving your bicycle. Okay? So as you're moving forward and as your speed increases, you're gathering more and more water that you can use for propulsive force. But your mass doesn't increase at all. And this is essentially what anti-gravity is all about, is you're using this energy that's in the environment. I mean, it's almost the same as say, if you had solar panels on your vehicle and you're gathering solar energy and you're using to do measurable work, except in this case, the energy is embedded in the fabric of space-time itself. And so it really becomes a question of what method, what technique do you use to gather this energy and convert it into some kind of propulsive, usable energy to push you forward. And the beauty of it is that as you go faster, your mass does not increase, but the available energy to assist you in going faster still increases. As you go faster, you have more and more energy available to use, and you're not carrying around a big load of fuel. That's the main difference between a field propulsion technology and, say, a rocket ship, where you have to carry every last bit of fuel that you're going to use to get to your destination. It has to be with you from the get-go. From the very beginning of your trip, you have to carry every last bit of your fuel with you. It's a tremendous detriment to your ability to not only accelerate towards the target or wherever you're going to go, whether it's the moon, Mars, or another star system. You know, you've got to carry everything with you. But if you're using zero-point energy, it's all right out there in space waiting to be used. And the faster you go, the more of it there is available to use it, to push you forward and get you going even faster. So that's really sort of the ultimate type of energy production system. If you can find a way to tap that energy without actually accelerating through space-time, just in a stationary sort of position, be able to use just the ambient energy that's in the local environment, and use it in a measured way so that you're not creating a reduction in mass and, you know, having your generator float away like a little flying saucer, you know. But so that's kind of how I got into this mess and why I'm talking to you now.
Well, let me first, I've got a question in the chat room. The guy's been very patient.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to ask it.
All right.
And I don't know, were you able to log on to Pal Talk?
Well,
Mark?
I have downloaded the program that should allow me to go into the chat room. I suppose I should click on chat rooms. Is that where I go next?
You go to chat, then you go to social issues and politics. You click on that, and then click on other, and then click on UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And it should bring it up automatically.
Okay.
You may want to turn off your volume or turn down the volume to make sure that you can actually hear it without hearing the feedback echo.
Yeah, I think the problem is here that I've got to go back and forth between my email and this website to create a login, a password, and nickname, and I really don't want to take time away from your audience to be able to sort of activate this whole process. So if you could just read the questions to me, I think that would probably be more effective at this moment in time, Paul.
I could do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
How do you think that they overcame the heat friction when they developed the ARV and test flew it?
Well, it's really kind of it's not so much a question of overcoming friction, like the friction of moving through the air. You have to remember that if you have a propulsion system, a field propulsion system, that is absorbing some of this zero-point energy out of the local environment, it will extend out beyond the confines. It'll extend out beyond the edges of your spacecraft, and it will be drawing this energy from a sphere-shaped area around your vehicle out to a particular event horizon. And everything that's within that sphere of influence will experience a reduction in mass. Now, if you understand the whole idea behind supersonic shock waves, if you understand the idea behind displacing water when a ship is moving through the water and the shock wave that comes off the bow, the waves that form the wake for the ship passing through the water, what this represents is the transfer of energy as the vessel is displacing the fluids around it, whether it's water or air. As long as you're in the atmosphere of a planet like Earth, and you're moving at a appreciable velocity through either the atmosphere, which is a gas, or through the hydrosphere, which is the water, the hull of your vehicle is going to be displacing this these materials, whether it's gas or water. Okay, now, if you have a system, a propulsion system, that is drawing this zero-point energy out of the environment, one of the things that happens is that it's going to reduce the effect of mass out to a given distance from your vehicle, which means that everything around you is going to be acting as though it has almost no mass. Now, if you understand the idea of friction is caused because the water doesn't want to move out of the way, the air doesn't want to move out of the way, and it's actually the force of your propulsion system pushing through the air at a very very fast speed. It's moving through the medium faster than that material can actually move out of the way, and incidentally the rate at which that energy is transferred into the medium around you is generally the speed of sound. Okay, if you are able to extend your field out beyond your vehicle and create a reduction in mass, including some of the surrounding air or some of the surrounding water, what that means is that you are reducing the effect of mass in all the air molecules or in the water molecules around your vehicle. And if you reduce the mass, mass and inertia, I think it was Newton said that, you know, anything that's in a state of acceleration wants to stay in that state of acceleration. Anything that is stationary tends to want to stay in a stationary position. And so in this case, you've got a moving vehicle, and you've got a stationary gas or a stationary body of water, and the mass of that material is going to give the effect of it wanting to not move. It's going to want to stay right where it is. So the fact that you're pushing through it creates friction because it's resistance to being pushed away or pushed aside as you travel through the material. But that is largely because even air and even water have mass. And so, I mean, every cubic foot of water weighs about 64 pounds. Now, air, of course, is considerably lighter than that. But you can imagine if you have a bunch of little bags of water, that cubic foot of water apiece, even if you tried to drive through, a wall of, individual bags of water, they each carried a cubic foot of water. I mean, that amount of water and the mass that it represents would stop your car on a dime. In fact, this is one of the things, are these safety barriers that they have on freeways now. Many of them are filled with water because it will compress and it will transfer energy, but it resists being pushed out of the way, so it slows your vehicle down. The same is true of a ship. The same is true of a jet aircraft moving through the air. You want to find a way to reduce the mass of the air around you, and this is how you overcome the friction, because once that material around your vehicle no longer has any mass, its inertia is negated also. If there's no inertia, that means it's pushed aside without any kind of frictional losses, without any kind of energy transfer, because it will provide no resistance to the passage of your vehicle. So that's essentially how you come over, that would be how you overcome those frictional losses. It's also why, and if you ever have the opportunity to see a UFO, and I've been lucky enough to see them probably on 24 occasions now, one of the things that you'll notice, one of the things that's really peculiar about them, is that visually they will appear to be moving at speeds probably in excess of Mach 5 or Mach 6 through the atmosphere, but there's no sound, no supersonic shockwave, none at all. And the reason for that is because these things are canceling the mass of the atmosphere around the vehicle itself, and so there's no energy transfer, there's no friction. And because of that, there's no supersonic shockwave created by the sudden displacement of these objects moving very quickly through the air.
Theoretically, a ship would not burn up because what it does is that it negates or cancels off the mass of the atoms, eliminating the friction.
That's right.
And thus...
That's right. Now, one of the other interesting side effects, I mean, if you've ever had an occasion to see a UFO at night in particular, often you will see a glowing trail of light, almost like a comet's tail, that will follow this aircraft, these vehicles. When they move through the atmosphere, there's almost like this little glowing trail that follows. If you see them making a right-angle turn at these tremendous velocities, and I've seen this at least two or three times now, you see this little trail that sort of outlines where they've been, and it persists for two or three seconds after they've gone. And it took me a while to figure out what that was all about, but when I really started to understand the dynamics of what's happening, the fact that this propulsion system is absorbing the energy out of the environment and essentially slowing down the spin of the electrons around the nucleus of the atom, one of the things that happens in its steady state, every atom has a steady state where its electrons are in different shells, and if they acquire a positive or negative charge, they become what are called ions. And you've probably heard of ion drive, in Star Trek and those kinds of things. Well, ions are basically either atoms that have an excess of electrical charge or a deficit of electrical charge. You can get positive or negative ions depending on whether it has more of an electrical charge or less of an electrical charge. So let's imagine that you've absorbed this zero-point energy out of the local environment, you pass through the air, and while you're doing so, the air is displaced without any frictional losses because the atoms, the structure of the atom is actually momentarily influenced in such a way that the electrons begin to slow down. And it's because of this reduction in velocity of electrons that the effective mass is actually perceived. But what happens after you pass by this given set of air molecules is that they kind of go back into their normal interaction with the environment. They reacquire the normal steady state interaction with this zero point energy that's already there in the environment. And what happens is the electrons spin back up to their normal steady state velocity. They jump back up momentarily to a higher orbit. And when they do so, they normalize. It's almost like a bounce, if you will. When you bounce a ball, it comes back up to a certain height, and then it starts bouncing back at more of a normal steady state level. And when that little bounce occurs, you give off that excess energy that has momentarily been inherited by reacquiring this interaction with the zero-point energy in the environment. So what you wind up with is this excess energy is being re-radiated from the molecules of air, and it's being re-radiated as a photon. And so the glowing trail, this little comet tail you see in the wake of UFOs, that's actually caused by photons that are produced by these molecules of air that are sort of reacquiring their steady-state interaction with zero-point energy environment. And that's why you see those ion trails behind UFOs. It's a real phenomenon.
Well, and I've got another question real quickly from the audience, okay?
Okay, go ahead.
They want to know what your website is so they can, see what you're doing and all. Will you go ahead and give them your website?
Sure. Pretty straightforward. It's www.markmcandlish.com. It's M-A-R-K, no spaces or dots or anything, and then the last name is M-C-C-A-N-D-L-I-S-H. It's markmcandlish.com. It hasn't been updated in a while. There's a couple of drop-down menus if you move your little cursor over some of the little words that are on that the front end of that website. You'll see a drop down menu. There's everything there from paintings and drawings I've done. You can, if you look hard enough, you can find the cutaway of the alien reproduction vehicle there. You can also find some conceptual artwork, some sketches of some of the strange aircraft that people say they've seen hovering near the edges of Area 51, including a monstrously huge lighter than air vehicle that is probably capable of moving the better part of a full armored division completely stealthily from one part of the globe to another in kind of a rapid deployment force. I've heard that these things have been sighted all around the world on various occasions. Many people think of them as triangular UFOs, but there are probably three or four different platforms that have kind of a triangular configuration. One, of course, is the so-called TR-3A, which was a target designating craft that worked in conjunction with the F-117A stealth fighters during the Persian Gulf War. There's also sort of a follow-up to that that was referred to as the TR-3B, that's supposedly an anti-gravity propulsion type aircraft. I've heard and seen a few people who've discussed and have claimed that there is such a vehicle. I personally haven't seen any evidence for that. I haven't seen any discussions of that in the defense community. That doesn't necessarily mean that it does not exist, but anyway, so what's the next question?
Well, I've got about three of them, and we need to shoot them in before we get into hour two, okay?
Okay, that's good.
Okay, and the first one, and I'm going to give you all three at one time, and you can answer them one at a time. If you need me to ask again,
okay,
I will go ahead and ask you again, or
all right. Go ahead.
Or tell you the questions again.
All right.
One, electronic malfunctioning cars, dying radios, and cameras and the like, in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, showed a field effect. Is this how you would explain what it is that we were talking about earlier, dealing with zero-point field effects? And does that cause that particular thing to happen? Second question is, if we have all this technology, why are we using rocket engines and is oil not needed? That's a part one and two of that question. And the third one is, do you think that we will ever see the public use of zero-point energy, or do you think the oil companies will use whatever they can to prevent it?
Okay. All right. The manifestation of this field propulsion and affecting vehicles, shutting down the electrical system, causing lights to go out, radios to stop, or even to come on, these are all legitimate side effects of the use of this kind of technology. Probably the best way to understand it is to go back and actually understand that if you are drawing zero-point energy out of the environment, that basically means that it is not there and present in its normal quantity to interact with the electrons and neutrons and protons in the atomic structure of everything, including the conductors that carry electricity through your car's ignition system, through your radio, your TV, any kind of electrical device that you have on. And in so doing, depleting this this source of energy, which keeps everything in motion, has a tendency to sort of undermine the ability of electrical circuits to pass current from one atom of copper in the conductors to another. Now, a lot of people don't really understand the process of electricity, what actually happens at the atomic level, but electricity really isn't so much electrons passing through a material like water through a pipe. It's been compared to that in many, the basic electronic courses when you talk about amperage and current and these kinds of things. But the best way to really understand it is let's say you've probably seen this little, it's kind of a toy that you can buy at a gift shop. And it's a little wooden framework, and it has like five or six little steel ball bearings that are all suspended by two pieces of fishing line from the upper and outer rails of this little framework. And if you take one of the little steel balls and you pull it out just a little distance and you let it go, it swings down like a pendulum, and it hits the other little balls. And the little balls all stay pretty much where they are, but the one that's at the opposite end will pop away so many inches, and it'll swing back in. And it'll strike the three or four little steel balls in the middle, and so what happens is these balls ricochet back and forth, but they all stay in a perfect alignment because of the nylon filament that hold them in position. But basically, this is a perfect mechanical model of what alternating current is about. Now, direct current basically would be like the first initial motion that you see, where the one ball comes in, hits the end, and this is pretty much what you see in the process of electricity passing through a conductor. You have electrons that are basically being absorbed and re-emitted at the atomic level one by one by one by one. It's probably one of the reasons why electricity does not actually pass through the conductor at the speed of light, as many people suppose it does. It actually only travels at about two-thirds the speed of light. Now, the other thing, too, is that you find if you were, really particular about this, and you can probably find this on Wikipedia or some other thing on the internet, but if you actually look at what's happening to the individual electron in a conductor, you find that the drift velocity for, say, 100 volts at 100 amps through a conductor of so many dimensional units across, you'll find that the actual drift velocity of any given electron is only about a foot per hour. Basically what it's doing, it's ricocheting and passing along the impulse, but the electrons themselves are not moving at the speed of light. And this is one of the reasons why electricity, at least the electricity that's passing through a conductor, is only moving at about two-thirds of the speed of light. And it's because of that absorption and re-emission process that occurs that really slows things down. So if you have a propulsion system that's pulling zero-point energy out of the environment, you're affecting the electrons that are sitting in the outer shell of all the atoms of copper in those conductors. And if you're affecting the speed of those electrons spinning around the outer shell of each atom of copper in those conductors, then you're depriving the electron of its ability to actually pass these impulses along in the normal fashion. And I think this is probably one of the reasons why electrical components have a tendency to actually, malfunction or stop altogether. It's why electrical activity in the ignition system of cars has a tendency to come to a stop. Now, there are some folks that actually will tell you that when you impart this kind of an influence on an environment, if you're drawing the zero-point energy out of the environment, that not only are you affecting the mass of objects that are in that sphere of influence, but you're actually slowing down the pace of time. And so activity that would occur in electrical circuits, say, you know, so many units of energy passing from point A to point B in a given moment of time, if you slow the pace of time down, it seems as though everything is ground to a stop, that there's no activity occurring at all. And when, in fact, what you've really done is you've kind of inserted yourself into a little fraction of a second where nothing's happening, and yet the rest of the world is passing around you and continues to move on, seemingly at a normal pace. But if someone was looking at you as you're sitting in that condition, you would look as though you were frozen in time. So it's all a matter, it's like Einstein said, everything is relative, and this is just a matter of perspective. Where are you at the moment that you observe all these things happening? If you're in the middle of that little region where zero-point energy is being drawn out of the environment, you may be experiencing time dilation, you may be experiencing the slowing of time, you may experience electrical circuits ceasing to function. There's also almost as many examples where a radio or a TV that are completely turned off suddenly come to life as though there's electricity flowing through the component. People have even been known to, in a moment of fear, try and turn the TV off and it won't turn off, so they unplug it and it continues to operate. And it's because an excess of charge is being dumped into that environment. And so what you're doing is you're basically energizing the circuit in the TV, and it's acting as though it has a power source. So there are lots of different ways that you can influence the environment, particularly when you have electrical systems that themselves can act as antennas to pick up these energy forms. It's just a matter of knowing how to do it or knowing how to manipulate these energy forms to get this to happen. Now, there were several other questions you had. What do you say we move on to the second one in that group, Paul?
Okay, so why are we using rocket engines, and it shows that fuel is not needed when fuel is not needed anymore?
Well, that's an excellent question. I would say the reason that we're doing that is because the production of rocket engines is something that, of course, involves the petrochemical industry to a greater extent than just about any kind of other propulsion technology. I mean, everything that you can get out of a rocket engine, you could probably do as well, if not better, using some kind of fuel propulsion system. But the fact is that these propulsion systems, which I believe, and I've seen enough evidence to convince me, are actually being used by the U.S. military, and they're in deployment, they're used on a regular basis. These propulsion systems represent a technological ace in the hole. They represent a technological edge that puts us out ahead of anyone else in the world that we might be at some point or another in a shooting match with, whether it's the Russians or the Chinese. You know, God forbid that should ever happen, because I'm sure that the Russians and the Chinese love their kids just as much as we do. But the fact is that, you know, if you have this kind of a technology, you hold it close to the vest. You don't go bragging to everyone under the sun that you've got it, because the minute someone else realizes that this is really real, this is something we can really do, all we have to do is figure out how the Yankees did it, you know? Then you've got an entire new weapons development war. You've got a competition to come up with something that's as good as or better than what the Americans have. And this may be one of the main reasons why people who discuss this kind of stuff, people like me, get ridiculed. It's why, some scientists will come forward and say, well, he doesn't have any idea what he's talking about. This is complete baloney. We don't have this kind of technology, and anyone who says that we does, it's poppycock, you know. So you have to understand that, you're going to have a tough road to hoe if you see this stuff. If you're in the military and you happen to be in the wrong place at the right time and you see some of these things, and I've met many people who have, you really have to ask yourself whether you're doing yourself and society as a whole any good by coming forward and describing what you saw. There's a good chance that someone will try and ridicule you. Someone may try to destroy your career. at the same time, you know, if you raise public awareness, which is one of the main reasons why I've agreed to come on the show with Paul, if you raise public awareness about this alternative technology, even if it's not something we see in the next 10 or 20 years, but if you raise awareness of this technology within society to the point where people, number one, accept that it's possible, and number two, begin asking questions, sooner or later you're going to have kids in high school right now that are going to hear this program and say, you know what, I want to find out more about this. I want to find out if McCandless is full of it or if he really knows what he's talking about. And when they go out and they start looking at the literature and reading it and they find out that, yes, it's really real, it really does exist, you know what, I think I'm going to study this in college because maybe someday someone's in the military is going to tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, you know, you're a pretty smart kid. You seem to understand this stuff. Why don't you come to work for us? And the next thing you know, they're in an underground base at Area 51 working on this very technology. And that's eventually how it becomes part of the mainstream. That's how it winds up being part of what we see day to day. My hope is that eventually, someday, you know, and you and I have our fingers deep into this pie, Paul. We both have ideas about how this stuff works, and you know, I think it'd be interesting sometime for you to describe, you know, for your audience, how you you yourself attempted to file a patent on a design of this kind, and we're told that in no uncertain terms you would not be allowed to receive a patent on your device because it was considered classified technology. So that right there is a shocker that maybe your audience is not aware of, but this stuff is as real as a heart attack. It really is.
Well, we're about to go into break again, and I can't get through the last question before the break starts.
Okay.
So can we start off the next hour, Mark, with the questions, you know, that were not able to be answered?
That's fine. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left to go, and one thing I want to bring up is the mere fact that Einstein, when he talked about traveling at the speed of light, that we cannot go past it because we would gain so much mass that there would not be sufficient enough energy to propel that mass. He was talking about zero-point interactions and energy as a mass unit.
That's exactly right. You're exactly right. And that's why Einstein maintained that it was never possible to exceed the speed of light because your mass would become almost infinite. And, you know, if you're you know, flying around in an archaic propulsion system like a rocket where you're carrying all of your fuel with you from the very get-go, it's, of course, understandable that your mass could increase as you accelerate through space-time. Just by absorbing all this energy that you're interacting with as you move faster and faster through the environment, like getting coated by more and more rain as you're riding through a rainstorm. So, yeah, it's true that that's what he was trying to say. But what he didn't really tell us was the other side, and this is probably why the Department of Defense was so touchy about declassifying everything that Einstein wrote, because I think at some point he said, well, but, you know, on the other side of that, if you were able to absorb that energy and use it to do work, then you wouldn't need fuel. You'd have a fuel-less propulsion system that uses energy in the environment to make you go faster and faster, and the faster you go, the more energy is available, and so the speed of light really becomes irrelevant. It's something that no longer is a limit to your ability to move through the environment. And that was probably at the point where somebody at the Pentagon, or, well, I don't even know if the Pentagon was built back then, but someone probably said, wait a minute, let's not get too public about this, because this is something we might be able to exploit and make serious use of for the military and for the defense of the United States. And I really think that's what happened.
Well, and we're about to go on the break, and we can even talk about that and how it deals with the Philadelphia experiment during hour two, which will lead into tonight's topic about the Gulf oil spill and how these alternative technologies would help. Well, we're going on the break right now, Mark, and I'd like to thank all of you. We will see you in hour two. Thank you again. It's break time. See you in a few minutes.
So red, and what the hell is on Joey's head? I grew up, I think the prison.
it up. I never knew we ever went without. The second floor is hot for sneaking out. And this is where I went to school. Most of the time I'd better face it, you. Criminal record says I've broken twice. I must have done it half a dozen times. I wonder if it's too late. Should I go back and try to graduate? Life's better now than it was back then. If I was them, I wouldn't let me in. Oh, 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 God, I every memory of looking out the back door. I have a photo of him written on my bedroom door. It's time to say it, time to say it. Goodbye, goodbye. Every memory of walking out the front door.
Welcome to the Prophecy Chronicles with your host, Paul Richard Price.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, no matter on where on the planet you are. And those in New Orleans, hello again from Paul Richard Price, the host of the Prophecy Chronicles show. We are now at hour two with my very special guest, Mark McCamish. And Mark, we were in the process of trying to answer all of the questions before the end of hour one, but we couldn't get through them all. And I think that's a good thing. I want to thank my audience for their participation tonight in this great topic of discussion with Mark, my guest. And Mark, here are the questions we weren't able to get to in hour one. Lily wanted to ask, do you think that we will ever see a public use of CPE, or do you think that the oil companies will use whatever they can use to prevent CPE technology from getting out to the masses?
Okay. I think that eventually we will see its use. I really am not in favor of the cap-and-trade legislation that the president's office is trying to promote. I think it would be devastating to the economy, given the situation we're already in. I'm sure that the less informed members of the oil and the petroleum industry might think that it would be a good idea to hold up or prevent this technology. But the fact is that there's so many other uses for petroleum, plastics, pharmaceuticals that offer so much higher returns on the investment than just breaking it down into gasoline and diesel fuel and burning it in our vehicles. I suppose that you know, if you have a pharmaceutical or a particular kind of plastic material, synthetic material, carbon or whatever, polyester resin, you take these composite materials and you can build so many different things with them in our society. There's so much more money to be made, distilling out the different chemicals that are in the crude oil and creating these other kinds of materials than just simply burning it in these different kinds of locomotion. But the real problem I think that you're going to encounter over time, and I think you and I and another one of our associates have talked about this on many occasions, is the macroeconomic influence of this kind of technology coming online and all the jobs that might be lost, all of the different industries that might be negatively impacted by this kind of technology. And I think that you have to understand, and this kind of leads into one of the other questions that you and I discussed during the break, and that is, you know, whether we'll ever see the commercial application of this zero-point energy technology, whether it'll ever be used either commercially to produce energy for the economy or whether it'll ever be scaled down in such a way that it can be used in an average household. And my answer to that is yes, I think it will, and the reason is that probably now more than at any time in history we see what can really go wrong with drawing crude oil out of the ground, particularly if it's a mile beneath the surface of the ocean, and then you go another 18,000 to 20,000 feet below the surface of the ocean floor, where the pressures are somewhere between 70,000 and 100,000 pounds per square inch. And these are monstrous pressures, and they're very, very dangerous things to deal with. I mean, these are the kinds of pressures that can cut through steel if they're focused and channeled properly. It's one of the reasons why we're in the situation we're in now. There's a lot of other factors that come into play, but my answer is that the petroleum industry stands to make so much more money using their crude oil, their raw material, as it were, for producing other things besides gasoline and diesel fuel, or even heating oil. They stand to make so much more money putting those materials into other types of industry that it almost seems silly that they would, ever consider trying to suppress or hold back technologies like zero-point energy. Now, you know, there's all kinds of other combustible fuels that you can use in the internal combustion engine. It doesn't mean that cars immediately have to be converted to electric motors. It doesn't mean that cars immediately have to stop burning any kind of combustible fuel. I mean, ethyl alcohol, hydrogen, methane, natural gas. These are all things that can be burned and leave a far smaller impact on the environment. And so, I really think that it's entirely possible that at some point there may be a time when we will see a commercial application of this technology. Probably. As a prototype generator station, I'm sure that there are probably underground facilities that are being used by the military that, if they're not operating on something akin to a nuclear reactor, they're probably using some kind of advanced zero-point energy technology to supply all the electrical needs of those facilities, because it's a power source that really never goes away. It can't be blocked, as far as I know, and it cannot be stopped. Unless you have another system that's even more powerful somewhere in the vicinity. So I really see this as being the wave of the future. It's probably a little too advanced to have, smaller units that are scaled down in the individual household, because under certain circumstances, this particular kind of technology can produce amounts of radiation. And it's really a matter of knowing how to do it and doing it effectively. From what I've seen, some of the components that are involved in tapping this technology involve things like liquid mercury. And, of course, liquid mercury is extremely toxic. So, you have to be very careful about putting these kinds of technologies out in the public. It's almost the same as if you were, talking about having a small-scale nuclear reactor for every home. It's kind of silly to think of scaling something like that down. I'm sure it could be done. I mean, we have spacecraft that have been powered by atomic energy, using the heat from nuclear materials that are so hot they glow red hot, and they convert water to steam, and steam drives a turbine. The turbine drives an electrical generator, and voila, there you go. It would be far better to have, say, a nuclear power plant somewhere and have it generating, you know, tremendous quantities of electricity that you then distribute through a network to the different households. And that's probably the same manner in which zero-point energy, when it comes online as a commercial source of electrical power, that's probably the same kind of way that it'll wind up being accessed by the average individual.
So you've answered actually question number two in one false swoop, which dealt with, do you think that they've ever used this technology to power homes?
Well, you know, it's really a question of where you're talking about. I think that there are places, probably somewhere out in the Nevada desert. There's probably places under every major city where these vast underground facilities are being constructed and have been under construction for decades. If you believe anything that some of the researchers like Richard Sauter have said about this topic, there seems to be a fair amount of evidence that there is an ongoing program of underground construction. And one has to wonder, if there's just the national security state that's concerned about, some great cataclysm that's going to require the construction of these things, or whether it's, a means of our survival if there's some kind of terrible event on the sun in one of the upcoming active sunspot cycles. It's hard to say unless you're on the inside and you have a way of talking to people who are knowledgeable concerning these things. But, there's been a what is called the Continuity of Government, or COG, program for, many years, going all the way back to probably the late 40s, early 50s, where the big concern was preemptive strike by, one of our enemies, whether it was the Soviet Union or the Red Chinese, or these days maybe even the North Koreans or Iran. This may shock you to hear, but I was told several years ago by a fellow who worked for the Border Patrol that on two occasions they had intercepted foreign nationals from the Middle East who were coming across the southern the border with Mexico carrying subcomponents to a tactical nuclear weapon. And you have to understand that if that kind of stuff is leaking across the border because we simply cannot cover, the 2,000 miles or whatever it is between the southern United States and Mexico, there is a great potential that some kind of terrorist activity involving nuclear materials may occur in the near future. They are definitely trying. There's no question that there are people out there that wish to do us harm. And so my hope is that eventually they'll get smart and they'll seal the border, and chances are it'll probably take a very serious act of terrorism that will finally, once and for all, force them not only to put up a barrier along the boundary between Mexico and the United States, but also station guards along that border that are prepared to shoot anyone who tries to cross. And it's unfortunate. I'm sure there are a lot of human rights people that would be up in arms over something like that, but it may come to that point where we simply cannot afford to take the risk of people with those kinds of intentions coming across our border any longer.
Well, I want to share something before I get into Skyman's question that he's been patiently waiting for me to ask.
Okay, go ahead.
I have been tested, and I have a precognitive capability. I am psychic. I had a vision. In the vision, I was in Las Vegas, Nevada at a party, at an apartment. At that time in the vision, I saw what looked to be Arabs shooting a surface-to-air missile up into the upper atmosphere. The next thing you know, you see a flash, a mushroom cloud, and I told the individuals to go in and to shut all the doors, tape them down shut, and to hurry up and get water before it got affected by radioactivity, and they didn't believe me in the dream. They said, you're pulling our leg. I said, we had a nuclear explosion. Try to turn on your electronics. And they said, well, I'll prove you wrong. They tried to turn on the TV. It would not work. They tried to turn on the computers. They would not work. There was no electricity. Well, when I told an individual about this, and it was right after the North Korean, the initial North Korean test of their first, quote-unquote, first atomic test underground that was successful, when I told this individual, who's a former employee of the Defense Intelligence Agency, he wouldn't talk about it. He shut up and got scared and wouldn't say anything.
And well, I mean, the earlier story from the Border Patrol agent that I spoke to really gives credence to what this young man or individual had to say about his premonition. I've had premonitions myself that have come true. I've actually saved lives with premonitions that happened literally moments before some terrible things were going to happen. So I'm completely open to the possibility of these things happening. I've spent a lot of time contemplating, if I was a Muslim and I wanted to do a tremendous amount of harm to the United States, where would I go if I had a loose nuke that I wanted to set off? Now, I'm certainly not suggesting that this is something that you'd want to do, but, you know, everybody thinks that the attack will come in New York City because it's, you know, the center of commerce for the United States, and certainly 9/11 did a tremendous amount of harm to our commercial interests around the world. But you also have to look at the philosophical differences between people of the Muslim faith, particularly the hardliner, radical-type terrorists that come out of the Middle East, and the things that they're really trying to say in terms of making a statement about their culture versus our culture. And so the two places that I thought of that would be very high on their list of places to go after would be a place like Las Vegas or a place like San Francisco. Las Vegas, of course, because of the, from a Muslim's point of view, the scourge of gambling and legalized prostitution and things of that nature. And then, of course, San Francisco because it's, sort of the heart of the gay movement in the United States. And so these are two areas that I saw as potential targets for them. Things that, I really believe that if they're being true to their own principles, are probably, from a propaganda standpoint, represent a much greater impact on our society, if they really want to make a statement about what it is they're trying to do. The other aspect of this that most people, don't see beyond, and, just in considering what I've just said, is that, of course, if these are anything other than just a dirty bomb, we're dispensing radioactive materials into the local environment, but actual physical explosions that involve nuclear materials, like an atomic blast, is the fallout will follow the weather patterns. It'll drift all across the United States. So a West Coast strike makes a whole lot more sense if you're really trying to harm a nation. Now, the other side, the flip side of this is that in places like Dearborn, Michigan, practically the entire city has become a Muslim island. If you go into Dearborn, you'll see mosques that have popped up all over the place. They have Muslim festivals there. The police protect the Muslims from Christians discussing their faith anywhere in the same neighborhood. You can find videos on the internet about it. And so you have to understand that somewhere, if you have people with any kind of intelligence, and not just people that are filled with hate, but if you look at someone who's motivated to take over a society and substitute their own particular philosophy, whether it's religious or political philosophy, they don't necessarily want to destroy this new shining star that they want to make their own. And so my belief is they probably won't do something like that, even though San Francisco and Las Vegas probably represent the worst of what we have to offer as a society in some respects. And, of course, it's all relative depending on your perspective. But, if these are the things that they think of in terrible, you would have to think that these are the places that they would strike first. But do they really want to destroy us, or do they just want to take us over? And my thinking is that they want to go after the latter. They really want to subvert our system. They want to take over. They want to possess what we have here, because it is priceless in many respects. And this is the same reason why I don't believe that we would ever, willfully make a nuclear strike against North Korea, because where do you think all the fallout's going to go? It's going to blow right back across the Pacific to us. And so, all of these, statements and the saber-rattling that's come from the leadership of North Korea and how we want to attack them and destroy them and everything else, this is just blowing smoke, because any real strategist who looks at this thing is going to say, well, we don't want to nuke them because, the radioactive fallout is going to come back to us. Anybody who has any brains doesn't want that fallout coming back. And, if it goes up high enough, it can circulate all around the world, and then everybody hates you for what you've done. So it's a no-win situation, for people who have this kind of stuff. And unfortunately, there are some people in this world that are so filled with hate that, they'll do almost anything to destroy the individuals, the countries, the people that they think of as their enemies, even if it means their own destruction. And that's kind of what martyrdom is all about.
Well, one thing I need to get to Skymon's question about, do you think that the executive branch of government, whether it be Congress or the President, has had knowledge about this technology?
Yes, I do. There's no question about it. The friend of mine who reported these things to me that he saw in the Lockheed Skunk Works facility in November of 1988 recognized a number of political figures there. The late Alan Cranston was one of the individuals in attendance there. I know from personal discussions with some of the staff. I used to live down in Rialto in Southern California, which is right on the edge of San Bernardino, which is about 60, 70 miles east of Los Angeles. The local congressman living in my area and who was serving the needs of his constituents throughout that vicinity, Colton, Rialto, parts of San Bernardino, Loma Linda, in that area, was Congressman George E. Brown, Jr., who was the chairman of the Congressional Committee on Space Science and Advanced Technology. So, it makes perfect sense that this little dog and pony show that they put on, displaying the alien reproduction vehicle and a number of other advanced technology aircraft, including the first generation Aurora. This was intended to show, the potential of what lays right around the corner. And so, yes, there were people, politicians from Washington, D.C., who were there in attendance, who had security clearance to see this kind of material, were aware of it. And from what the witnesses I have spoken to who were there have told me, this was by no means the most advanced examples of what they had to show. I've talked to people since that time who have worked Air Force Plant 42, which is the facility where the Lockheed Skunk Works is located. It's also the place where the B-2 bomber, stealth bomber, was manufactured. It's right in the vicinity of Lancaster and Palmdale. And I've spoken to witnesses who said that they, on multiple occasions, have seen flying saucer-like vehicles come in and be sort of recovered, if you will, outside the Skunk Works facility in a process that involved... you've probably seen these little motorized turrets that the power line guys work on the power lines, where it has a basket that goes up on an arm that extends up, and they have controls in the basket that allow them to move this motorized turret around so they can move from station to station along a power line without having to climb all the way back down and move this the platform that they're on. The recovery of this disc that was seen on several occasions outside Skunk Works involved a circle of about 10 or 12 of these vehicles just like that, and the baskets were straight up in the air above the motorized turret, which has a steerable set of tires and so forth under it. And suspended from each one of the baskets was a tarp that stretched all the way to the ground and went from one basket to the next, creating what appeared to be a huge black cylinder that was probably 100 feet off the ground and maybe as much as 200 feet in diameter. And one night in 1992 or thereabouts, this witness said that he saw a lens-shaped black disc hovering above this circle of vehicles. silhouetted by the lights that were glowing at a lower level inside the Skunkworks building. He said that he saw this disc lower down into this cluster of vehicles. The arms all extended out over the middle of this thing, covering it completely with the tarp, and then the whole group of vehicles trundled into the Skunkworks building. The hangar doors closed. The lights around the facility, the Plant 42, came back on. In fact, they even had the local sheriffs come in and close all the surrounding roadways so no civilian cars could come anywhere near this site and see what was going on. Now, I just happened to get a ticket down there from the Lancaster County Sheriff's Department, I think it was, or maybe it was Kern County, I forget now. But anyway, one of the sheriff's deputies confirmed everything that I just told you, that he'd seen it for himself, and it was astounding. So the same individual who saw this recovery a week or two later said that he saw the same vehicle being rolled out under cover of all these vehicles with the tarp, that the little arms extended up, creating this cylindrical shape again. After a while, the vehicle silently rose up and out of the midst of these vehicles, and then after receiving some light signals from, using a handheld spotlight from a man who was on the ground, no radio traffic at all, this thing, from a standing hover, shot the entire length of the runway going due east, went past the individual who was observing this, and disappeared out into the darkness of the Mojave Desert. And it did all of that in under a second, just pew, like it had been fired out of a cannon. Absolutely no noise, no supersonic shockwave, nothing. And the young gentleman, the engineer who told me the story, was a fellow working on the B-2 bomber stealth bomber. And he told me that it having that sighting literally changed his life, that he realized at that moment that not only do we have this technology, but everything that they're teaching in physics class in college is probably a lie to some degree or another. I mean, you know, there's certain things that you just, if you're able to do the things that he saw, he says there's certain things that are wrong with what's being taught in college. And he said it was pretty obvious that, there was a whole other branch of physics that's not being discussed.
Well, and here's another question. It talks about Bigelow Enterprises and Bigelow Aerospace.
Okay.
Is Bob Bigelow aware of this technology that you're talking about? I know he is because he reopened up NIDS under a new name, you know, the National Institute for Discovery Sciences.
Right.
Now he's reopened it as a branch of Bigelow Aerospace Space Systems Development.
Yeah, I've looked at their website. You can go up on the web, and you can even apply for jobs working for his company if you have some understanding of the technology. One of the things that, Bob is trying to do, Bob Bigelow is trying to do, is that he's trying to start his own aerospace company. I think it's wonderful that he's doing so. I have no doubt that he has either seen or probably understands that the technology exists. I think he's trying to get a foothold into either the production of or the commercialization of that technology. One of the things that he requires when you apply for a job is that you have U.S. citizenship and that you're able to pass an NCIC criminal background check because you will be going through the same national security check process that I went through before I worked in the Air Force and before I worked at General Dynamics. And it's a very lengthy and detailed and thorough process. They basically want to find out if you can keep a secret. And I think he's positioning himself in a very strategic way because he probably has friends in the Las Vegas area. I mean, after all, he's a billionaire. He probably knows a lot of very influential people. But I imagine that, he's positioning himself in a very strategic way and possibly to be one of those outlets for this kind of technology when it finally comes to fruition. And as I recall from the website, he's openly soliciting, papers, if you will, that describe what people believe may be the functional process that would allow you to successfully create a system like this to be able to tap into things like zero-point energy or to be able to manipulate a field in such a way, an electrical field in such a way that you would be able to produce a kind of anti-gravity effect. It's all very exciting. I've personally had so much of the whole national security state kind of situation. I mean, I've really felt the sharp end of the stick, so to speak, when it comes to the displeasure of the federal government when they don't like what you're saying or what you're doing, and so you know, I'm not inclined to participate in what Bob Bigelow is doing, unless of course it involves some of the research into anomalous and paranormal phenomena, because I've had experience in those areas myself, and you know, like this young fellow that that called in and said that he had psychic experiences and he had these visions of things that happened. It's a real experience. I've had it myself, and there were many years as a younger man where I really thought that it was all just you know, the kind of stuff that you see on TV or in the movies and science fiction. But you know, having had some of these paranormal experiences myself, you know, it's something that really deserves scrutiny.
Well, and let me just rephrase that again. The person was not somebody who called up, Mark. It was me who had the vision.
All right.
And one thing that I want to get into, and we only have about 15 minutes left.
Okay.
Is the Gulf War or the Gulf oil debacle?
Okay.
Now, I used to live in the Gulf. I know people who work for ExxonMobil. They could have had that already cleaned up by now. They could have done it within 2 weeks' time. That's not the only time they've ever had that kind of accident happen. Why do you think, Mark, they're not doing a thing about it? Is it to push cap and trade?
Well, you know, this is the $100,000 question, or should I say $100 billion question, that everyone is asking. And you know, and it's not just people on radio talk shows that are asking this question. One really has to sort of look at the where the money's going, and what, you know, to the average person, the idea that this monstrous oil spill could have been cleaned up in 2 weeks, it sounds like an utterly preposterous statement. But you know what? You're absolutely right. And it could have been done if, number one, the proper safety measures had been observed. You know, and I think there's enough blame to go around for everybody, so I'm not going to, you know, get into finger pointing. But you know, I would invite your audience to go up and do a Google search on the phrase Black D, like in capital letter D, like in David. There is a video that you'll find on the website for this company that's based over in the United Kingdom. They have a material, an absorbent material, that particularly targets crude oil with an absorption process. They have a video up there where they show seawater with crude oil floating in the water. They sprinkle this stuff, it looks like hamster food, on the oil. It immediately absorbs the oil, and then you come along with something that looks like a butterfly net, a screen, and it scoops up all this Black D, these little pellets that have absorbed the crude oil, and it leaves the water in pristine condition. There's no dispersants, there's no vapors, it's just the oil that's been absorbed into these pellets, and then the pellets can actually be burned as fuel. I mean, it's a marvelous invention, and yet you hear no mention of this whatsoever. Now, you probably know that the president has apparently refused to allow any of these big suction-type ships to come over from the Netherlands and other places that have a lot of experience cleaning up oil spills and things. He's prevented these ships from coming into the Gulf and operating in U.S. territorial waters because of something that I believe is called the Jones Act. And I don't know what this particular piece of legislation, I don't know when it dates back to, but the crux of that legislation was that any ships that are operating in U.S. waters will be manned by you know, members of mariner unions that are based in the United States. And so my question would be, okay, how many union jobs have been lost as a result of the fact that they have cleaned the mess up? How many union jobs have been lost all along the Gulf Coast? Fishermen, boaters, the maritime interests, the commercial interests, you know, all of these different people who belong to the various unions, how many union jobs have been lost as a consequence of not cleaning up this mess? Now, to make matters even worse, and this is something I shared with you earlier today, I didn't even know this until just a couple of days ago. But do you know, you remember the Exxon Valdez running aground in Prince William, or was it Prince William Sound? I think up in Alaska. That spill was far less than what we're talking about now. They were using steam and other types of materials to wash the shoreline, all these rocks and things along the shores of Prince William Sound. And the vapors that were created as a result have pretty much killed all the people who were responsible for that cleanup. They've all died of lung cancer and various ailments as a direct result of exposure to those toxic chemicals. Nobody's talking about this. In fact, there's only one person that I know of, and I don't recall what her name is, but a lady who would be an excellent guest for your program, Paul. She wrote a book called Silence on the Sound, and it documents all of the health problems that these people who spent several years cleaning up this toxic oil spill, all the health problems that they had, none of which were addressed by either Exxon or the government, from what I've read. So one has to really be very concerned about what's going to be happening along the Gulf of Mexico, cleaning up all these oil balls of oil and crude and stuff that are the little tar balls that are showing up, particularly the dispersants that they are introducing into the oil even before it reaches the surface, hoping that they can get it to spread out. I spent a lot of time looking at what's happening down there, and a lot of people don't understand that oil has a tremendous amount of toxicity, crude oil in particular. It's loaded with different kinds of bacteria. It's loaded with all kinds of chemicals in their most virulent and raw form. And just a quart of crude oil can toxify up to 250,000 gallons of seawater. Let me say that again. One quart of crude oil can poison 250,000 gallons of ocean water. It can kill all of the bacteria, the phytoplankton, and the other kinds of microscopic sea animals. They're at the very bottom of the food chain. So all the other little tiny fishies and things that live off this stuff, the bigger fish that live on the small fish, the toxicity spreads through the entire food chain. It's one of the reasons why eventually they probably won't allow any fishing in the Gulf at all. But here's the thing. 38% of the Gulf of Mexico is 20 meters or less in depth. 38%. That's where 90% of the sea life is. And that also happens to be where the oil is going, is the shallowest, most productive waters. And that's why this thing is going to turn into such a terrible environmental catastrophe. It could have been stopped with these boats that would suck up the oil. It could have been stopped using this product called Black D. It could have been stopped any number of ways. And the fact is they didn't do it. In fact, what the president did do was order a moratorium on deep water drilling. Now, I heard this recently on another talk show, and I don't think I'll go as far as to mention where or who I heard say this, but it turns out that there are a lot of deep water oil reserves, known reserves, that are on the continental shelf off the coast of Brazil. Now, Petrobras, the national oil company down in Brazil, is just dying to get a hold of all these deep water oil rigs, drilling rigs, because they know that the oil is there. And it, of course, would be very lucrative for them to be able to tap into this oil. Millions, if not billions, of barrels of oil. And good quality oil, too, the so-called sweet crude. Now, if you put a moratorium on all these drilling rigs, some of which, cost $2.5 billion to build, they cannot sit idle. All of the men that worked on those ships, these drilling rigs, they can't sit idle doing nothing. And so Brazil is just dying to get a hold of all of those drilling rigs, bring them down to a position off the coast of Brazil, and drill this oil. Well, guess who one of the biggest investors in Petrobras is? George Soros, one of Obama's buddies. Now, he stands to make billions and billions of dollars from that investment if all these oil rigs leave the Gulf and they go down to this position off the coast of Brazil. you can just imagine. You can just imagine how this is going to affect the U.S. economy. It's going to pull a tremendous stream of money from the oil industry that would ordinarily be going to citizens of this country. It'll be going to the citizens of Brazil or somewhere else, or to the investors of that that corporation. So, they say that there are three aspects to every crime. One is motive, one is opportunity, and the other is means. So, if you have someone who's heavily invested in the green movement, and we know that Al Gore is invested in the Chicago carbon tax exchange or with those carbon credit exchange. We know that Obama is invested. We know that former CEO of Fannie Mae, I think his name is Kenneth Raines, owns the patent for the process of trading carbon credits. This fellow is going to stand to make millions, if not billions of dollars off of the so-called green movement and the cap and tax legislation they want to push through. So there's a tremendous amount of motive. Now, if you're the chief executive of the United States and you put a moratorium on drilling and everybody has to move somewhere else, that's going to affect the trading of carbon credit. It's going to affect the movement of money from one country to another. It's going to undermine the economy of the United States. All for someone's political gain? To me, this is unconscionable. To me, this is right up there with high crimes and misdemeanors. Not only is it like, the violation of the RICO Act, where you're actually manipulating market in a way that is detrimental to the citizens of this country, and you're helping yourself in the process, but a tremendous conflict of interest. So, I can see why nothing is being done. Nothing is being done on purpose.
Well, and we have 5 minutes left to go, so I want to briefly do a recap on this and to finish it up. How do you think zero-point technologies or the ARV technologies will affect oil as we know it right now, and how do you think it'll make a positive change in this if we're able to implement these particular technologies right now instead of later?
Well, I think the first thing that'll happen is that you'll be able to take some of the burden off the environment from the gases that are produced by the internal combustion engine. It won't happen overnight. The millions of jobs that people fear will be lost, because of the impact of the technology. I don't think that that's going to happen any more than jet-propelled aircraft replaced the propeller-driven aircraft in a week. It didn't happen. It didn't happen because people need to learn about the new technology. They need to learn about the implementation of it. They need to learn about the precautionary measures that need to be taken when you're using this kind of technology. There's so many different things that people will have to learn in order to be able to use this technology in our society. Obviously, I think there are some great benefits. The pinnacle of which, of course, is the possibility of interstellar travel. Imagine being able to go to the moon and back in a single afternoon because you're able to travel at such incredible speeds that it's literally like a trip down to your neighborhood grocery store. These are things that are possible right now. It's just a matter of declassifying the technology and perhaps bringing the world together in such a way that we don't see each other any longer as enemies, but as people who are all existing on the same planet. And we all have hopes and dreams. We all have desires to get ahead and to have a comfortable life. It's really a shame that there are a number of extremists around the world that have kind of a very narrow perspective, a singular view. You can certainly admire Muslims for the devotion to God. As a Christian, I'm sure that you have a particular kind of devotion to God in your own way, as I do. But I think when you talk about harming and killing other people to praise God, I think you've lost touch with the true intent and the message of what God is all about. And that's just my personal viewpoint. But I think that at some point we're going to have to all stop being enemies. We're going to have to come together and realize that we can coexist. We can live together. We can look towards a brighter future with less pollution. and exploit these technologies in a way that is really going to be beneficial to the environment as a whole. And, I've got a 67 RS Camaro I'm restoring, and I would love to put a big engine in it, but I'm actually looking at putting a more modern engine that will be more fuel efficient and that will, be less polluting and, enjoy the benefits of the look of, the mid-60s with all of the high-tech and clean technology of today. So, it's really just how you approach it. We can do this, and it takes political willpower in the halls of Washington, D.C. and other places around the world. And, by the way, I don't think we're the only country that has this technology or understands it. There are several other countries I believe have it right now, and I think that perhaps they may be putting pressure on the United States to be a little more forthcoming about the fact that this technology is real and that could help to solve a lot of our problems.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, so I want to thank you again for being on the show, Mark, and your website is markmcCandlish.com. And if my guests want to send you an email pertaining to what we talked about tonight, how can they?
You can send an email to, I'm at Gmail, it's the same thing, it'd be markmcCandlish@gmail.com. It's markmcCandlish. From time to time I've done this, and I get a flood of interesting emails. If there are folks out there that have an understanding of this technology and maybe some hands-on experience, or people who've had some remarkable UFO sightings that they'd like to talk about, I'm always happy to listen and occasionally interact and correspond with some of these folks. You'd be surprised how much you can learn about these kinds of technologies talking to people who've only seen manifestations of how it's used or what it can do. You can learn a lot about the technology. I've even talked to people who've been victims of the so-called abduction experience who described components to me that exactly match the kinds of things that my friend said he saw at the Lockheed Skunk Works facility. So, that by itself is a very strong verification from independent sources that didn't know one another, that authenticated what was being said on the one hand by the witness from Lockheed and the Lockheed Skunk Works building, and people who, for every other intent were reporting kind of a fringe sort of, experience, a paranormal experience, and yet they had details and factual material that was being authenticated by other accounts. And so, I'm open to all this stuff. I try not to reject anything except, people who claim they're God and this kind of thing. But, I welcome that. So.
Well, and one more thing I want to tell my guests, my listeners, that my guest for next week, again, will be Dan Smith for 2 hours, talking again about eschatology in the aviary. And, Mark, thank you again for being on the show. You will find the truth here. What you do with it is up to you. Thank you again for listening, all of you. And, Mark, I'd like to call you in a couple of minutes.
Sure.
To do a recap with you, if that would be okay.
Well, that'd be fine, Paul, and I want to thank you again for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things. I always think that it's good for the public to raise their awareness of these kinds of things, to understand that just about anything you can imagine is possible if you just have the right knowledge. I always like to encourage kids to stay in school, to learn as much as you can, because there's so much out there that we're not being told. And you really need a kind of a foundation to be able to understand all the things that are still being kept from us. But once the curtain is pulled back, you need to be prepared to stay in school.
Okay, and thank you again. God bless you all, and have a good night.